Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
When you have just the trousers on, it's easy to take them trousers off as well. But when you're naked completely, I think you have to find the shirt and try to put it on again and that you're dressed normally again.
Yes, indeed. The wit and wisdom of Arsene Wenger on getting dressed in the morning. Now, the reason I play that, apart from it's one of the most brilliant bits of football anyway, is because my next guest is the wonderful John Sperling. If you know your football writing, you will know that he is basically one of if you had football journalist top Trump, or the sticker book of football journalists, then my next guest, John Sperling, appears pretty much near the top, probably playing for AC Milan or something. John Sperling, how are you, sir? Did you enjoy that bit of Arsene?
I did, yes. It's a good start to the interview, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully. So for those of you who haven't been following it or up to it, it's 4-4-2, it's everything and everything. Isn't it? Just tell us who you've been writing for in the past, who you're writing for in the present.
Yeah, so how long have I been doing this? Freelancing for about 30 years. When Saturday comes, 4-4-2, what have I got? The 11 Friends in Germany is a good magazine as well. 11 Freinder, as it's called.
11 Freinder, I was going to say. That's a good shot.
Yeah, and multiple podcasts as well. Eight books we've got as well now.
The thing is, you see, because... like you said, 4-4-2, when Saturday comes, brilliant. Podcast, yeah. The whole bit, you know. I mean, I get upshot on a regular basis as well, just to keep things, yeah, sort of. And now football is part of the culture. Everybody loves football. But the period you're writing on, if you had said in 1984, shall we say, yeah, you know, Heysel just about, that football will be pervasive, it will be fun, it will be on the social medias, although obviously it wasn't back there in time. People could, there's no way, football's barbaric, you know, the football followers are scum, etc.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way that you could possibly have foreseen the way football was going in the 80s. I mean, in 1985, the Sunday Times famously wrote, it's a slum sport, ooh, played in slum stadia, watched by slum people. And that is before the Bradford fire, which took place that month, and the Heysel disaster, which also took place that month. So no, you couldn't have seen it. I mean, English football was in a bad way. The infrastructure was rotten. The disasters in the 80s, well, I've mentioned two of them, like you've got Hillsborough as well.
Yeah.
They could easily have happened in previous decades because the grounds weren't policed properly. The infrastructure was crumbling. The very stands or terraces that people sat on were falling apart as well. Yeah. So in the 80s, you got various stands shut down. If you ever went to Molyneux in the 80s, for instance, two sides of it were shut, condemned. And that was a kind of like a symptom of where football was at. It was at a low ebb. And actually, sports like snooker and like darts, interestingly, because darts is big at the moment, were seen as much more, you know, television friendly, family friendly sports. So no, you could never have foreseen what football was going to become.
Because yeah, family friendly, not because there were very, I mean, those, the away, you know, the stands behind the goals, you know, like the shed, for example, there's no seats. It's, you know, you're standing, you're getting crushed around. It's so you cannot have a family friendly sport. I mean, they say thing about, you know, kid, you know, I've been at, you know, people have been watching. I used to take my kids to watch the, you know, in the 70s. Well, you were very, a very reckless parent pretty much if you were in the away stands, because it was, because it was not only that, but you were swayed around by the mob of, you know, of humanity, as it were.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, the terrorist culture is very much part of it. I mean, it always interests me because when I've been writing the 80s book, I've spoken to a lot of fans, and there's oddly still a lot of nostalgia for the 80s. And when you pin people down about why, they say, well, because in those days you could go as a teenager with your mates, you could just rock up on the day and pay on the gate and get in, which you can't do anymore in the current climate. It was more edgy in a way that perhaps, you know, Top Flight grounds aren't now. But the other side to that is there was a chance that you could go to football and not go home.
Yeah.
It wasn't inclusive. You know, as we've said, there's no catering for families. The facilities for women were shocking. The toilets, I mean, someplace there weren't any. So I would say on balance, football is better now. But I suppose in the 80s, you could broadly say it was still the working man's game, which you can't necessarily say that now.
Should we get this one out of the way first of all? Casuals. Yeah. If you remember the 80s, you remember the football casuals. So it was the Pringle sweaters. It was the, you know, everybody looked great and the whole thing, but they were quite likely to either sleep with a Stanley knife or beat the living Watsits out of you. I mean, it was that territorial.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. And I mean, the hooliganism was recurrent right through the decade. So, you know, I talk about in the book, interviewed a couple of people involved in the more bystanders in the Luton Millwall riot at Kenilworth Road. Another incident in 85 where, you know, it seemed like London's hooligans, not just Millwall, descended on Kenilworth Road for an FA Cup replay because it wasn't all ticket. I mean, it's staggering that no one died that night because there were 10,000 on the away terrace, which should only have held 5,000. I mean, it is remarkable when you see the footage now, a thin line of policemen, how no one died that night. So it is that kind of decade.
So, but it's this is the thing, because we talk about the English game and how it begins to morph. And I suppose one of the things was, it, Espana 82, I'm sitting in a studio in southern Spain. Malaga Malaga is like 30 minutes down the road. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we have a Bocoron in the house. John is holding up a Malaga football mug, and you don't know how happy that makes me. How do you get that, John?
I went to a Malaga Real Madrid game a few years ago with some mates. It was amazing. A beautiful October evening. It was lovely, lovely game. So, yeah, I've got a bit of a soft spot for Malaga, although they're not in the best of shape at the moment, are they?
Yeah, it's a sleeping giant coming back up the thing. Don't worry
it
about
is,
that.
It is. Largest that night was epic.
Was it in Malaga? Did you see them in Malaga? Nights. Did you see them in Malaga?
Yeah, I did.
Right. So, anyway, but football kind of starts to get a little bit sort of less, a little bit more sexy, not in the way it will do in the 90s, but 82, you've got, you know, the England team, they've qualified for the first time, because in the 70s they were in the wilderness in terms of World Cups.
Yeah.
And does that start to make a change, do you think, on that point? And then,
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as you say, England haven't qualified for anything since 1970. They didn't even qualify for that because they'd won the World Cups. They got through. But England are in the 82 and 86 World Cups. You know, they do okay. 82, they come across West Germany at their peak, if you like. And then they come across Maradona at his peak in 86.
Yeah.
But I think you can see that what's starting to happen is that the chairman or directors of the top clubs like Tottenham with Irving Scholar, David Dean at Arsenal, Martin Edwards at Manchester United are looking and thinking, how can we get more for our clubs? So they start to look at the commercialization side of it. They start to look at the corporate side of it, you know, and getting the more middle class fans in. They make a power grab in the mid 80s where they basically threaten to break away unless they get extra voting rights. So they get more voting power. And there's not, the contracts are laughably small, but they're looking to get more money from TV. Mm. So by the end of the 80s, ITV break the cartel with the BBC, bid more for football. And that's because B Sky B now appear as a player. They drop out of the race, but the mere presence of Sky means that ITV bid more for live football. And what you have at the end of the 80s and 89, of course, is that showdown at Anfield between Liverpool and Arsenal on a Friday night, which is like Sunday spectacular, Monday night, Friday night, all rolled into one. And it was an epic kind of TV encounter played under the lights, pushed back to a Friday night simply because the Hillsborough disaster meant it, the game had to be postponed, the original game. But that game was, I suppose, football at its most epic, with converging themes of tragedy, of salvation, a young team coming through. And suddenly TV companies think, you know what, football is worth investing in.
Because that the horror of Hillsborough meant that something had to be done in terms of, because the horror was being beamed directly into people's living rooms, and that point, and we'd had Bradford as well, and those shots as well of people, just horrendous shots, and Heysel, of course. So something had to be done. You needed some, and you know, as well, a different game, but Will Carling describes them as old farts. You know, the perhaps the FA are the most fragrant of old organisations in that respect.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd quite happily sat there being chairman and going, well, that's the way it's been, that's the way it's always going to be, etc.
Yeah.
But businessmen coming in rather than chairmen, if you like, from the old school, helped open it for business. And you think about the first sponsorship deals. I mean, okay, it might be sort of Sharp or something, or these tiny, you know, Amstrad or something, but it opens that chink, and that's the start.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, you have various sponsorships coming in the 80s. And a lot of these directors at clubs, as you say, they hired business managers. They're the ones who, you know, under the radar kind of are sorting things out. Definitely. And I think, you know, what happens is, as you say, football chairmen at the time were quite conservative in the sense that many didn't want change. They mistrusted TV, for instance. They thought that live games were bad for the game. But what changes everything is the Taylor Report, because what he explicitly says in the report is that top flight stadia should be all-seater. And he says it in the report. And then the government can't really ignore that. And so nor can football chairman. So that goes ahead. So the early 90s is all stadia, like building sites, that kind of thing. And what that does is it starts to attract a more kind of middle class audience into football, gets more expensive, and so it changes the dynamic and the clientele at games.
And also, and I will go on about this, I will bang on about this until the thing, Italia 90, Des Lynam, the three tenors, it's in Italy, it's got that wonderful three tenors backing track, you've got Toto Scarlatti, the opening. Nobody had done football like that before.
No.
With Des Lynam. It had always been Jimmy Hill, it was always been football. Lynam comes on, he smiles, he's got opera in the background, all the ladies go fantastic. And then that sets up what it does, because Lynam was
You know,
and that sets up the whole run into it reaches its peak in Euro 96, at which point we are full on for the Premier League.
Yeah, definitely. Football became sexy in 1990. The World Cup was cool. As you say, Pavarotti in the background. You had Gazza's tears. And England did well getting to the semi-finals. But there's the other things, like you have Fever Pitch, written by Nick Hornby, which suddenly pulls in, you know, again, middle-class punters think, oh, yeah, I can, you know, could get into this. You've got the amazing FA Cup semi-finals of 1990, Liverpool against Crystal Palace, Man United Oldham, which sets the tone for the decade, because Man United win the FA Cup, despite Ferguson apparently being up for the sack. Liverpool start to wobble. So there's various factors coming into play, which means that football is about to become, well, as Sky put it, a whole different ball game.
And also a whole new
ball game.
Yeah, and also you've got the romance of the cup, because you've got the crazy gang, Wimbledon. They go 88, they go to play the mighty Liverpool. Nobody gives them a chance. I mean, no. Sanchez, Dennis Wise, what's his face? Vinnie Jones?
John
Fashion. There is no way this lot should be anywhere near the respected grounds. And of course,
it captures
the whole imagination of the nation.
That's right. I mean, our chat so far has been quite serious, but I'd focus on a lot of hopefully a more upbeat aspects. You've got amazing cup stories in the 80s with Wimbledon, Coventry City beating Tottenham. You've got Ricky Veer's story from the early 80s, Norman Whiteside in 85. And then, of course, you know, you've got the Oxford United's League Cup victory in 86 as well, with Robert Maxwell as chairman, which is a great story in itself. And then you've got, as say, at the end of the 80s, the birth of the fanzine movement as well, which shows that actually fans aren't knuckle scraping buffoons. You know, a lot of fans care deeply about the game. The inflatables craze as well, which comes in with the Man City fans. I talked to the guy who actually, started all that, Frank Newton at Manchester City. There are some... It's almost like you could almost see the signs of what football would become, but you couldn't see it. you couldn't have predicted it at the time.
Yeah.
Because football seemed to be ripping itself apart.
Well, say from 85, like from Hillsborough, from Bradford or whatever, through to 85. And then you look at 95, the year before the Euros, you've got Loaded, you've got Lads Culture, you've got people buying old sort of CCP, the retro shirt thing. Suddenly it's fashionable, it's cool. You've got guys, pretending to be, Mockneys everywhere. The literati are supporting Arsenal because of Nick Horn. I mean, it is insane. It's good fun, isn't it?
It does. It takes off. And that's in my next book, which I'm doing on the 90s. Probably not a surprise. I've done the 70s, the 80s, onto the 90s. So that certainly comes into it. I think the other thing to remember about the 80s is that obviously at the start of the decade, English clubs were massively successful in Europe. Yeah. You've got Liverpool, Aston Villa, Nottingham Forest winning the European Cup, Ipswich, Tottenham, the UEFA Cup. And so the first half of the decade, English clubs have never been more successful in Europe. But then because of high sort, you have the European ban, and you have that exile of English clubs for 6 years, and there's definitely like a full stop in the middle of that decade that sums up what's coming after that.
It's interesting you mentioned sort of Ricky Villa and Oswald Edgar, because they were seen as exotic foreign players. That Ricky Villa, when he dribbles past everybody, and it was like, look at these, these two foreign players, because the Scottish players didn't sort of count because they were British, and yet here we are now, and you've got we had obviously because of the big money that's come in, so there is a nostalgic look, maybe a nostalgic look back at that, and you can also argue that the national team doesn't, I mean, it gets to quarterfinals, etc. But, Robert, Captain Marvel is there. What a character he is.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, England did have some great players in the 80s. And I interviewed Terry Butcher for the 80s book. Ooh. And what he said is different. It's a much more combative, direct game. Because these days, a lot of clubs play like mini Manchester Cities, don't they? Well, they're slightly better than Manchester City now. But they copy that style. Whereas in the 80s, you've got quite a lot of clashes of style. You've got Luton, Nottingham Forest, which are good. Tottenham, quite easy on the eye. But it was a more aerial game. And what Butcher said is that defenders and attackers prided themselves on our heading ability.
Yeah.
They spent a lot of time doing that, which obviously isn't, as we know, necessarily a good thing. But it was a more combative aerial game. And Brian Robson kind of embodied that. And I think in the 80s, managers would rather go with a Brian Robson than, say, a Glenn Hoddle type. As we saw, Glenn Hoddle was never necessarily a fixture in the England team, was
because he was seen, because those sort of players were seen as a little bit foreign, not to be trusted, not in the good English manner. You wanted someone like Butcher, who's got half his brain hanging out, wrapped with a blade, 'tis but a flesh wound. You want him rather than Hoddle's silky skills, where he can literally sort of dictate. Now, of course, I mean, Hoddle they would build a team around Hoddle.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting that the players like Hoddle, like Ray Wilkins, Glenn Hoddle, they went abroad.
Yeah.
Hoddle went to France to play at Monaco under Wenger. Ray Wilkins went to AC Milan. And I think that Trevor Francis, went to Italy as well. So there's a feeling that anyone who dwelt on the ball for more than 2 seconds wasn't to be trusted, in the headless chicken approach, which you often see in 80s football. There is that, and it's a shame they have to go abroad.
Isn't that wonderful Ian Rush quote when he doesn't go to Juventus or AC Milan? Ian Rush, and he comes back and says, I couldn't say it was like being in another country, which I thought was one of the best comments ever.
I think he said that was a Kenny Dalglish wind-up. But Luther Blissett said he sort of bemoaned the fact he couldn't get hold of any Rice Krispies in Milan, which was a big problem for him. But I think he said it was at the end of an interview, and it was an hour long, and that's the only thing anyone ever remembers from that interview with Blissett.
Next time he appeared at Fiorentina, he was showered with imported Rice Krispies. When you look back at these, Ray Wilkins and Butch, I mean, what a guy on both on and off the pitch. I mean, he's often overlooked. I mean, he had his, as Americans say, he had his demons. But, he, again, intelligent footballer, as is Hoddle, as is Captain Marvel.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what it showed is that, English players were very skillful. I mean, there's other players like Ricky Hill at Luton, who was a very respected midfielder in the 80s. You had some amazing wingers. you know, people like Tony Morley, who played for Aston Villa in the FA in the European Cup final and set up Peter Withe for the winner. And so there were skillful, gifted players in the 80s. And I think it's kind of quite easy to overlook that. And I think that, you know, there's a danger, isn't there, with Sky in 92, that anything before that now gets kind of airbrushed from history. And I think that one of my reasons for writing this book on the 80s was to show there was life before the Sky era.
But one thing that has been airbrushed is AstroTurf. I mean,
that's true.
Now remember that. I mean, that was going to be the all-winning, all thing. You could play. Play on a wet Wednesday in Port Vale. Didn't matter if you were. They just sort of broken off. And honestly, thank goodness we don't have too much AstroTurf around anymore.
That's right. So QPR were the first to install it at Loftus Road. And I think there was a lot of talk about the unnatural bounce, you know, the description of the friction burn sustained by players. Glenn Roeder said he described the pain as exquisite. He said you can't quite describe the pain from it with this, you know, piece of skin hanging off his leg. But I mean, the part of the reason for doing it was there was a series of horrible winters in the UK. But I think that clubs were looking to kind of diversify a little bit. So on the AstroTurf in the summer, you could have hockey competitions, for instance. You could have kids coaching. So it was trying to design to get more money in for smaller clubs like QPR and Luton.
Yeah.
Oldham as well had a plastic pitch, didn't they? Or artificial turf, Preston as well. And it was supposed to be like a model for the future. But fortunately, you know, by the early 90s, these pitches are kind of, you know...
But those ideas about making it family friendly, I mean, they're in their infancy, Sid, but you can kind of see what they're doing. And that comes into full fruition, which is going to be obviously covered in your next book and beyond with that whole situation now where we have, you know, cannons and fireworks and the whole nine yards.
That's right. So Elton John, you know, he's very much behind the Junior Hornets at Watford. You know, Luton do the same. I think smaller clubs have to make sure that they cater for, you know, younger fans to get those families in. So, yeah, that you can see it all happening. It's starting to come together. But as I say, it has its fruition in the 90s because in the 80s, football is still not a particularly attractive product for families for the reasons we've discussed.
Is there a moment that encapsulates for you that sort of period of the 80s? Is it, you know, or the brave new world of the 80s? I mean, is it there any particular bit that you can almost pinpoint it and go, right, that was where it sort of, that sums up what I'm writing about?
That's a really good question. Well, we talked about 89 at Anfield, haven't we? The end of it, perhaps. I suppose, you've caught me out there. Is there a moment that
I've not met you, Johnny. In the last minutes of the interview, eh?
Yeah, I suppose. God, you caught me out here. I suppose there are some. You've got the Coventry Tottenham FA Cup final, which is when you look back on it now, quite a kind of iconic moment because it was perhaps the last classic cup final of that era at a time when the FA Cup final was the match on the calendar because there were hardly any live games shown.
It was an all-day thing, wasn't it? It was the wives, it was the bus thing in.
That's right. And it's a wonderful game on a wonderful sunny day. So that's kind of quite an iconic game to look back at, I think, at that time. Yeah, definitely.
Right then. The book is called Go to War, Football on the Brink in the 80s. It's by the brilliant John Sperling, who is speaking to you today. John, if people want to find you online, obviously you're relatively easy to track down.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, or X as it is now, so at John Sperling 1 on Twitter. I'm now on Blue Sky as well, and you can get the book from all the usual places. Amazon, it's on Waterstone.
You can order it via our own virtual bookstore and cut out the middleman. There you go, John, there's a link. We can send you a link. You can order it straight after this interview, so there you go.
Brilliant.
The book is called Go to War, Football and Brink in the 80s. Brace yourself, ladies and gentlemen, because I can see myself in a few months' time doing football in the 90s, and that will give John enough time to prepare for that last minute question that I nutmegged with him. Sorry, mate. The book is called Go to War, Football on the Brink in the 80s. It's by John Sperling. John, thank you so much for your time today, and Merry Christmas, mate.
Thank you for having me on, and Merry Christmas to you and all your listeners as well.